evening and welcome. It's KVZ Arts, a program dedicated to arts and entertainment in our region, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. The original Renaissance Pleasure Fair is going for the 53rd year in Irwindale. One of the mainstays for the fair is the Poxy Boggarts, the self-described drinking group with a singing problem, together for over 20 years now. Ross French spoke with members of the group, Stu Venable and Greg Wilson, better known as Stork. To start tonight, there's a relatively new program as part of the Kids Block programming on KVCR-TV and a number of other PBS affiliates. It's educational and entertaining. It's called Space Racers. Lillian Vasquez has more.
I'm speaking with J.J. Terry, who is a voice actor, and you have a role in one of the new PBS animated programs called Space Racer. So it's very new to public television. What is Space Racer's mission? What are they trying to do with Space Racer?
Well, Space Racers is trying to introduce young viewers to science, and particularly the science of space and space travel. When they started writing the show, Richard Schrager, who was the creator, along with his former college roommate Julian Cohen, they decided to come up with an animated series. Richard was inspired by a trip to the Smithsonian Air and Space Museum in Washington, and they originally wrote it as a screenplay, but decided instead to develop it as a television series. And fortunately, we've been very fortunate to have NASA sign on as consultants and to make sure that everything that we're doing is accurate.
Well, that's really cool. Not everyone gets to partner with NASA.
True.
Tell me about some of the characters and their roles. I know there's Eagle, Robin, and Hawk.
Well, Eagle and Robin and Hawk are all our young space racers. Cadets at Stardust Bay Academy. Eagle is the hotshot. He's the racer with unrivaled speed and agility, and he has confidence. He's pretty much the leader of the space racers. Robin, her primary goal is education and experimentation and observation. She's the sharpest mind of the group. She's the whiz kid, the brainiac.
Well, I'm glad it's the female that's the sharpest mind of the group.
Yes, yes, she is. Well, and of course, we have Hawk. He is a team player, and he pays attention to facts and figures. He has incredible strength and a perfect memory. He's a big spaceship, but he has a big heart.
Oh, very good. Now, who is the program geared for? What age group would you say is primary for Space Racers?
Well, the show is geared for preschoolers, but I think kindergartners and first and second graders would find the show fascinating.
Yeah, I think some of the topics that they discuss, they're kind of first grade, second grade level, and I don't think they'll fall asleep by any means. It's very engaging, the music is fun, and the whole show is very entertaining.
Well, I think so too, and I think that it's a way for kids to get that first introduction in space. When I was growing up, we'd all get up early in the morning to watch the Apollo missions and things like that. This is a great way to reintroduce kids to space.
You know, PBS Kids is one of the most highly acclaimed and most trusted in kids programming. What's the message that Space Racer is trying to do? Is it just trying to educate about space? Is that its primary function?
That's a part of it. What Space Racers is doing is to educate about space. It's to have a respect for science and to learn more about not only the world around us, but the world out there in our own galaxy.
Yeah, I think it's quite different than most of the other PBS animated shows in the kids' block that are currently being seen on KVCR and other PBS stations throughout the nation. Now, you're one of the voices on Space Racer,
actually,
or you're a couple of the voices, aren't you?
Yes, I'm two of the voices. I'm Coot, professor at Stardust Bay Academy. He's the Academy's chief engineer and mechanic, an all-around master of gizmos and technology. We've had a lot of fun with that character. The other character that I do is Vulture Albatross, a greedy chairman of the school board, always out for himself and trying to find ways to make things work for him. Unfortunately, they always backfire.
Good lesson there.
Yes, so exactly.
I kind of figured Vulture was going to be kind of the bad guy if there was a bad guy in the show.
Yeah,
you know, you've spent much of your career as a voice actor. How did you fall into that career?
Well, my goodness, early on I started off doing what they called looping. We would get in Japanese cartoons, anime, and they would bring in actors to dub the Japanese cartoons into English. But I've also done other work. Working with our director, Mark Risley, I've worked on a show called The Mr. Men Show. I did several voices on that. And as a result, he called me in for this. I've really enjoyed being a part of Space Racers.
Was it something you knew you were going to be? I mean, when you were a kid, did you think, I'm going to be a voiceover? Did you like doing it at a young age? Or how did it come to you?
Well, I grew up during the age of Saturday morning cartoons.
As did I.
Yeah, and I enjoyed the different voices of the characters. I was very shocked at an early age when I discovered how many voices Mel Blanc did on the old Warner Brothers cartoons. People like Paul Frees, who did so many different voices. And so, yes, as a kid, I practiced doing unusual voices and accents, and it got me dragged down to the principal's office more than once.
But look, it paid off, I'm sure, right?
Well, I was destined to be a part of Space Racers because I know when I was in school, my father asked how I was doing, and my teacher said he takes up space. So thank you very much. I'm here all week. Be sure to tip your waitresses.
When you go to audition for a job in voiceovers, mm-hmm. as opposed to maybe when you're auditioning for an acting role, it's all about your voice, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, take me through what an audition might be and what you plan for and how you prepare for an audition in this field.
Well, usually an agent will contact me and will send me some dialogue to look over. And I'll either record at home in my home studio, or I will go to the agency and record at their studio, and we'll read through the copy. They'll generally give you a breakdown of what the character is, who the character is, what his relationship is, whether he's a good guy or a bad guy. And sometimes, if you're lucky, you'll even get some artwork that'll show a picture of the character.
So that gives you kind of a visual.
Yeah. So you know whether the character is tall or short, heavy or thin, and so on.
So the voice is for a tall person and a thin person.
Yes.
What would a voice sound like then?
Well, Vulture and Coot. Coot is sort of short and round, and he's an older character. Vulture is very angular and lean. So those are the things that I work on.
So when you go in, after you've tried a voice, I know mm-hmm. we were talking earlier, and you said with one character that you had, you knew you had the job because you had it spot on. Can you share that?
That was back when we were doing the Mr. Men show. The Mr. Men books were a very popular series of children's books, I think, way back in the 70s. In fact, my son had those when he was growing up. And they had characters like Mr. Tickle and Mr. Grumpy and Little Miss Scatterbrain and all of these different characters. And one of the characters that I was asked to read for was Mr. Rude. And they had a number of people from Great Britain there. And the British have always had sort of a rivalry with the French. So when I started doing Mr. Rude, I came up with a French accent. And that broke them up. That got me the part.
No disrespect to any of our listeners out there that are French. We love all our listeners. So that's just one example of mm-hmm. coming up on the spot and going with it and mm-hmm. what you think.
You take chances. I've auditioned for things with a voice that I thought was dead on and would see the cartoon later on with someone else's voice, and it would be like 110 degrees different from what I came up with, and it would surprise me.
Wow. Well, JJ, thanks so much for your time. JJ Terry is a voiceover actor. He can be heard periodically on Space Racer on Fridays at 1 p.m. on KVCR-TV, our sister station.
And if any of your viewers and listeners would like to know more about Space Racers, you can check our website at www.spaceracers.com.
Thanks, JJ.
Lillian Vasquez in conversation with JJ Terry amongst the voices of Space Racers. Now, a couple when we got that conversation. Space Racers, part of the Kids Block programming on KVCR-TV. As KVCR Arts continues, it's music and conversation from the Poxy Boggarts, a mainstay of the original Renaissance Pleasure Fair in Irwindale, now in its 53rd season. KVCR-TV is also 53 years old now, and that makes KVCR-FM 63. However long you've been listening, thanks for your support. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also streaming live at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Thank you so much for your support.
Drink it up, this bar won't close tonight, for I might see better days.
The original Renaissance Pleasure Fair in Irwindale is now in its 53rd year. One of the mainstays for the fair is the Poxy Boggarts, the self-described drinking group with a singing problem.
2, 4, 6, and 8, now 'tis time to inebriate, so drink it up.
I don't need your sympathy.
They've been together for a bit over 20 years now, and it's still fresh. More importantly, it's still fun. Ross French thought so, and tracked him down.
So now I sit at the bar, and the barkeep kindly said,
So we're here with two members of the Poxy Boggarts. Gentlemen, could you introduce yourselves?
Yeah, my name is Stu Venable. I'm the director and one of the founders of the band.
My name is Greg Stork Wilson. Everyone calls me Stork. And I'm the lead funny of the band.
The lead funny? What exactly does that mean?
Well, we've discussed this with the band. There's a reason that Mick Jagger is the front man. It's not that he can't play instruments. It's just that he's a lot more charismatic and funny than everybody else.
Okay, I'll buy that.
And most of the rest of us are neither funny nor charismatic.
So, for the uninitiated, how would you describe the Poxy Boggarts?
Drink it up. Drink it up.
Well, we bill ourselves as the drinking group with a singing problem, but I think it's more than that.
On stage, we portray a bunch of drunken, mostly harmless louts who don't really understand the spectacle that we make when we get on stage. And most of our music reflects that sort of attitude, except that we rehearse a lot so that the music actually sounds, we think, really good. So it kind of surprises people when we sing something that's very crass and very socially awkward, yet the harmonies lock for the most part, and the music is accessible, and it's worked.
Early on when Stu and Bill were coming up with the idea for this band, they said, we've all heard sea shanties done badly. What if we try to do them well? What if we actually harmonize and come up with great harmony and new words? And you know what? Sure enough, it really worked. Sort of the archetype for this, since this is NPR and everybody's very intellectual, if you could imagine Toby Belch and Falstaff in a band, that would be this band.
One of your songs on one of your albums is the works of William Shakespeare put to music.
I think there's actually been a couple of sonnets that have been put to music.
The band just celebrated its 21st birthday. Ugh. Tell me a little bit about the membership. How many original members are there? How many Boggarts are there?
2, 4, 6, and 8. Now 'tis time to
The band started out in 94. There were originally 6 members, and then the second year we lost someone for work, and that's when Stork joined, was in year 2. And I think at our height we had 12 members, and right now we have 10.
So, and of those, you're one of the originals. Are there any other originals still with the band?
Yeah, Jerry Wheeler, who's our trombone player and tenor, and Bill Roper, who's a co-founder, and he's bass player and baritone.
So how did you get your start? What brought you guys together?
I'd started working fair after I got laid off from McDonnell Douglas. I had worked with a guy when I was in college who was in a madrigal group that worked at the fair. And in high school, I used to sing a bunch of madrigals, and he would start humming something, and I'd recognize it and start singing along with him. And then he's like, oh, you gotta come work fair someday. And I joined his group, which was called Good Company, and they were a madrigal group. They did a stage show. I did that the first year, and at the end of that season, they decided, oh, we don't want to do fair anymore. And I had so much fun doing it, I'm like, I can't not do this. So I talked to Bill, and we decided to found a band, kind of based on a couple of the songs that they did and a couple of songs that the group Stork was in.
For men of great strength, there is no match for Stout. He grew Samson his hair and gave Atlas his might. Even great Hercules with his 12 trials triumphant found time in his journeys to toss back a pint.
Be they lambics or lagers or bitters or bocks, or pilsners or porters or mead sweet and clear, or the stouts of all bisons or ales brown or pale, it's the same to our drinkers, just bring us more beer.
Men's songs, where the men would come up and sing a ribald tune in the middle of their shows. We said, let's make an entire show of that kind of thing.
Bearing in mind that there's a large tradition in early music of men's stuff. There's catches and rounds that are all very male-centric.
Be they lambics or lagers or bitters or bocks, or pilsners or porters or mead sweet and clear, or the stouts of all bisons or ales brown or pale, it's the same to
And Stu had the brilliant idea of, like, why don't we just do those with men? And we're like, no, that, oh my God, that might actually work. It's ostensibly the launching point was, why don't we just have a men's group that just sings about being men and being dumb and goofy and Falstaff and Toby Belch, and we'll talk about beer and how much our wives hate us. And you know what? We're here 22 years later. Who's counting? And it seems to be working, I have to say. The other thing is, this band, and I say band because it's strange to me, is full of band geeks and choir geeks. There's some other people who have been in a couple of rock and roll bands, but for the most part, this is all full of people that have done madrigals and done choir for their whole life. Here we are, choir geeks, singing all of this secular stuff, and it's actually very fun.
Are any of the members full-time musicians, or do you all have day jobs?
Everyone has day jobs. Jerry, at one time, was a working musician. I think he's always kind of had at least some other kind of job. All the rest of us have day jobs.
It's the same to our tankers. Just bring us more beer.
Now, regarding the music, and you mentioned this, the songs of men, by men, for men, the simplest way, I think, to say this, that some of your songs might be considered naughty.
Body. We like the word body.
Body, it's much okay.
With a B-A-U-D-Y, not B-O-D-Y.
And in fact, you also have a song that you sing at the fair to warn folks that they might hear some songs that have some bad words here or there, and they might talk about beer or sex.
It's you and me and the barkeep, and the barkeep's not looking so bad. I'm not saying I'm desperate, but it sure seems that way. So what do you say? Let's roll in the hay.
But what a lot of people might not realize is that you're carrying on the tradition of some of the more ribald madrigals and shanties of Elizabethan times, the double entendres and the clever puns. Is that fair?
Absolutely.
Yes.
In fact, our show originally kind of had a line we couldn't cross, and then they started the Rogues Reef stage, I'm going to say in 99 or 2000, and they asked us to bring in more ribald songs. One of the songs we brought in was Aboard the Good Ship Venus.
Which is a semi-traditional sea shanty. Right, you know, there's a lot of fraternities that have sung that.
And it was filthy without us even having to modify it at all. And it's still, to this day, one of our most popular songs.
Yep. We messed with the arrangement a bit, but we didn't change the words or anything.
So what do you say? Let's do it again.
We'll kind of segue into the fair, since we've kind of already touched it a little bit. How would you describe the Renaissance Fair to someone who's never been there?
I think the best way to describe it would be to describe the first time I went. I was a teenager, and this would have been in probably the early 80s, and it was literally like walking back in time. Once you paid your ticket and you went inside, except for the other guests around you, the modern world kind of disappeared. People started talking differently, they're dressing differently, the buildings look different, the food is different, the music is different, people's mannerisms are different, and it's almost like taking a step back in time. To me, that was the thing that was most magical about it. You just kind of forget about the troubles of modern life, and you're back in a simpler, certainly idealized depiction of an era that is historically fascinating time. You know, the term Renaissance has come to mean this sort of this awakening of the civilization. That's truly what it was. And you get to sort of see that stuff in flesh and blood. It's awesome.
So what do you say? Let's roll in the hay. So what do you say? Let's roll in the hay.
Stu is much more erudite than I am. I always tell people that there is something there for everybody. If you want to go and eat great food, it's there. If you want to go see a joust, if you want to go climb a rock wall, if you want to go see shows, there's 7 stages with shows every half hour. If you want to see pageantry in the streets, you want to see performance art, if you just want to go and watch people, it's all there at the Renaissance Fair. And it's huge. People think, well, I'll go for 2 hours and leave. No, you can't make it past the first serpentine, you know? There's crafts, there's events, there's stuff happening all the time. And I tell people that if you can't find something that interests you at Renaissance Fair, then you're dead inside. It is. There's just pageantry and stuff that happens all around you the entire time.
So tell me a little bit about what the weekend is like for you guys. What's Saturday and Sunday like for the Poxy Boggers?
Our call is 8:30. We have an all-cast meeting. And then after that, we go and we set up our area. Because the Rogues Reef, it's a stage and it's also a quasi-environmental area. There's a tavern and there's a little shipping house. We set stuff up for that, get all of our props out, get everything set up, do a sound check on the stage. And then usually around the time we're getting finished, hopefully, a cannon goes off. And that tells us that the front gate have opened and that the patrons are coming in. And then from that point on, it's nonstop. We have 3 shows a day at Rogues Reef and then 1 show at the Golden Jubilee stage. And basically, we're there supporting and watching the other acts. And then when we go on, we do our 25-minute show, and then we're off, and we get ready for the next one. We talk about what happened in the last show, anything we could change. And then also, during all that in-between time, we're interacting with people who come in to visit us at the Reef, or when we go out, we're interacting with people. It's almost a continuous performance for the 6 or so hours that the fair's open. It's hectic, but it's incredibly fun.
Stu's right about that. If we're not on stage, we're off stage, but there really is no off stage at the Renaissance Fair. You're always on stage. And oftentimes we're out hawking for our show. We're not getting food and water so we don't collapse on stage. We're out making sure people come know where our show is. We're out trying to gather stuff, or even hawking for other shows, because we're all in sort of together as one big family. We're trying to make sure that everybody comes, because if somebody comes to see the show in front of us, they'll stick around to see the show after us. So it always behooves us to make sure that we're out in the streets, making sure people are aware that we're there and come and see us.
So how do you stay inspired? I mean, you've got 7 weekends that you have to do this. When you get to week 5 or week 6, are you dragging a little bit, or do you constantly find ways to keep it fresh and inspired?
There is a mantra that is shouted and repeated at every cast meeting in the morning, and that is, what day is it? And everyone shouts, opening day. And the attitude is, every day is the first day of fair. When you're perfectly fresh, everything is new. You've had an entire year off, you've spent a year missing it, and now you get to your back and you're gonna put on your best. That really kind of resonates with you. If you think about how it is on that first day of the season, it's very easy to think back to how that was and to recreate that every time. I think also for our shows, we don't have a set list. We have a pool of songs that we'll pull from, and every show is a little different. I mean, there's 1 or 2 songs that will be the same, but we are constantly switching songs in and out. And then we'll get through 2 or 3 weekends of fair and someone will say, hey, we've never done that song that I wrote. Oh yeah, okay. But it's constantly mixed up. And I doubt we perform the exact same set more than 2 or 3 times per season.
Yeah, we tend to improv a lot. We have sort of a skeleton that we sort of riff off of, because as a musical group, if you stray too far, nobody's going to know when to come in. Being the theater geek that I am, it's like on a long-running show. All right, after month 4, how do you stay fresh? It's the exact same thing as Stu said. These people have paid a lot of money. They've taken time out to come to see you. They deserve the best show that you can give them. Every time should be opening day. Every day should be the best show that you can give these people that have come a long way sitting in the sun to watch you. And that's inspiring. I come out there and I see a full house. How can you not be inspired?
Do you guys ever get to a point where you're trying to crack each other up, or do you try to play it as straight as you can?
We do that constantly.
Stu breaks so easy. So it's like, I guess I'm the Tim Conway of the group and he's Harvey Korman. See, look, he's doing it now. And that keeps it fresh for us. Yes, we do mess around on stage, but it's not to the detriment of the show. I think the more fun we're having, the more fun the audience has. It's a feedback loop in a way.
You touched on this a little bit, but there seems to be a really neat relationship between the different musical groups that call the Rogues Reef stage home. Bells of Bedlam, the Merry Wives of Windsor, the Dread Crew of Oddwood. What's that experience like working with those other groups and even invading their stages periodically?
We actually have a very good working relationship amongst us. There's always a little bit of rivalry, I think, but now it's definitely a very supportive rivalry. And we do mess around with each other and we do occasionally invade each other's stages. But I think everyone is supportive and is pulling to make sure that everyone else has a chance to put on the best show they can. We make sure we're on stage on time, we're off stage on time, so we don't step on the next guy. I mean, this doesn't happen very often, but if groups are doing the same songs, they will often coordinate so they don't do the same song in back-to-back shows. We help each other out with merchandise and stuff like that at the end of the shows. Almost all of the acts that will be out there will be out to help us build the stage in the weeks coming up to fair.
Do you guys have a lot of regulars who come see you every weekend?
Surprisingly, yes. Yeah. I'm constantly amazed, yeah.
And I would think there's some newbies who come in and are, despite the warnings, are a little bit surprised by what they're hearing. Do you have any good stories about people getting up shocked and walking off?
There's no good stories about people getting up shocked and walking off. I have to say that the reason we came up with the warning is that what we quickly discovered is that people don't mind being shocked as long as you warn them. It's like, we're going to be filthy. If you're okay with that, that's okay. As long as you give somebody an out, if they choose to stay, then you can say, look, we've already given you the warning. It's when we don't warn them, then they're suddenly blindsided by some obscenity or some reference that makes them very uncomfortable. That's the line that gets crossed, and that's when people storm off.
It's weird. There's something that happens when you become a parent, and I'm saying this as a parent myself. You forget how to read. Because we have these signs, and they're going to pass two or three of them. And one of them is like 8 feet wide and 4 feet tall, and it tells you that the stage you're coming to is NC-17, and it's not appropriate for children. And they'll bring them anyway.
It says it right there. They walk in with their strollers, and we're all parents and, you know, responsible people. We even have signs. We'll run up and say, please take your children elsewhere. And if they choose to stay, then we question their parenting skills. But it's their choice. As long as they know that this is what's going to happen, everything's okay.
There's actually two warning songs we do. That's why we wrote them, because they basically, once we start singing, it gets the audience's attention. They get quiet. They listen to what we're doing, and suddenly they're paying attention. And we do either one of those two songs, and they both end in a four-letter word. If, by that point, they haven't gotten up to shuttle the little ones away, they tend to.
And they do it with a smile, and usually they thank us. They're like,
right.
Thank you very much. Occasionally there's people that say, no, it's okay, and they stick around and they realize that was a bad choice. But you have to give them the out. And then we don't humiliate them on the way out either. That's the thing. Everybody seems to be okay with it. Once you have the audience buy in, it's okay.
Oh, welcome to the Bogger Show. If you brought kids, you might want to go.
Ross French in conversation with Stu Venable and Greg Wilson of the Poxy Boggards, performing at the original Renaissance Pleasure Fair in Irwindale. As KVC Arts continues, we'll hear about some of their music, including something that made it to the Super Bowl. In the meantime, though, thank you for your support, as KVC Arts has gone from a monthly spotlight to now a weekly, hour-long program. Thank you for listening as well as for your support. For the rest of tonight's program, it's Ross French in conversation with Stu Venable and Greg Wilson, members of the Poxy Boggards, a group that's been around for just over 20 years and is part of the entertainment lineup at the 53rd Annual Original Renaissance Pleasure Fair in Irwindale. But it's not only at the Ren Fair that you may have heard their music. Think Super Bowl.
I wear no pants. I wear no pants. I wear no pants.
I was doing some research for this. I was popped up. I was looking up some different songs, and Fair Phyllis I saw popped up, and I sang that in high school, and I was just like,
see?
Fair Phyllis I saw sitting all alone.
Feeding her flocks here to the mountainside.
Oh, yeah.
Fellow medical geek. Yay.
See what I mean? Band geeks.
Now, even if people aren't necessarily familiar with the name the Poxy Boggards, there's still a chance that they might have heard your music. Their gamers might have heard some of your music on a couple of games, Warcraft 2 and Hellgate London. But most famously, Stu, your song, I Wear No Pants, was used by Levi's during the 2010 Super Bowl to promote Dockers.
Non porto pantaloni. Non porto pantaloni.
I got a call around Thanksgiving of 2009. From the ad agency that was pitching the commercial for Levi Dockers. And they said they wanted to use this song.
And as is was with most of these tales, he goes, who is this really?
I spent 3 days thinking it was a practical joke that one of the guys in the band, probably Bill, I assume, put someone up to this, because they gave me a phone number that was up in San Francisco.
I wear no pants. I wear no pants. I wear no, I wear no, I wear no, wear no pants.
And I thought, this is a total joke. So I got this voicemail message, and I'm like, this is a joke. I'm not going to fall for this. 2 or 3 days later, the woman calls back again, and I start talking to her. And then she starts talking about budget and needing me to fill out paperwork for rights. And then I think I called Bill, and I said, okay, I want to ask you straight up. Did you put someone up to this? He's like, holy cow, no, that's awesome. So I'm like, and then the whole thing kind of fell into place after that. But they had heard it in a YouTube video that a fan had filmed at one of our shows at the fair. And they were doing Google searches up there at this ad agency, putting in different phrases with pants or no pants in it. This YouTube video comes up, and it comes up pretty high on the list, even before the Super Bowl thing for some reason.
Yeah.
And they listened to the song. They went, oh, this is great. Let's figure out who these guys are. And next thing you know, it had a song at a Super Bowl commercial.
Now, that song has been covered by a variety of a cappella groups over the last few years. If you search for them on YouTube, you'll find many covers of I Wear No Pants. That's got to be kind of a thrill to have your work sung by so many different performers.
It is. It's incredibly rewarding to think that a song that I wrote for my band, someone thinks well enough of it to perform it with their own group. That is a very rewarding experience to hear a group I've never heard of or I've never seen before doing a song that I wrote. And very often doing it very well.
I remember like listening to Rockstar say, I don't know what my hit song is going to be. And I always thought they were full of something. Because you always think, well, that's obviously that's the number one hit.
I wear no pants.
Well, Stu wrote the song and he brought it to the band. We're like, oh, okay, that's fine. That's cute. We have, whatever. And we performed it and we put it on and we thought nothing else of it. And all of a sudden it becomes the breakout hit. We're like, I now get what all those rock stars are saying. Who knows what the breakout hit's going to be?
And what was the inspiration for that song? Where did I Wear No Pants come from?
I wasn't wearing pants when I wrote it. I was in my underwear, actually.
TMI.
Sorry, but I wanted a funny, silly phrase to base a sort of Madrigal-like song around. And I looked down and I wear no pants. And that started it. And then I had to use Google language tools to come up with a pidgin version of German and Italian.
Which sells the song, really.
It really does.
Google Translate makes everything funnier.
People who actually know those languages tend to wince when they hear the grammar of them.
Or are like double overlapping.
Right.
It's just awful.
So do you get people who come up to you now and say, hey, I just heard this song, or I remember you from the Super Bowl, or they put that connection together?
I don't know if I've ever had that happen. I know our fan base was like super ecstatic when they found out the song was going to be in the Super Bowl.
It's weird because we weren't actually performing it in the Super Bowl. They actually hired a bunch of people, taught them the song, and then they're singing it. And the weird thing is, there's actually another video out there somewhere of the people that were in the video singing I Wear No Pants in a bar while they're watching the video. And I'm like, that's our song. Whoa. That's the weirdest thing I've ever seen. Because they thought it was their song, but it was very surreal.
Well, they rented it.
Yes. Yeah, yes, they did.
So do you guys have any personal favorites that you really enjoy performing? Any songs that stand out above the others?
My favorite song to perform is a song entitled Tender Love Ballad.
Really? You picked that one?
Yes, that's my favorite song to perform. The refrain is, please have intercourse with me. And it's a song about a hapless fellow who's trying to woo his woman. But the reason I enjoy performing the song is we have a bit at the end of the show. We ask all of the gentlemen in the audience to stand up and sing it to the lady that they came to the fair with. Sometimes they sing it to two ladies. Sometimes two men sing it to one lady. Sometimes a lady sings it to a lady, or a man sings it to a man. And it's hysterical watching the reactions of the people who are being sung to. Because in some cases, it's like an old married couple, and you look at them and you think, oh, they're in their 60s or 70s, and they're not going to go in for this. And the guy will stand up and stagger up to his feet and hold his wife's hand and start singing to her, and she's nodding yes, and it's awesome. I love that. I love the reaction to it.
Don't mind the rain or the rolling sea.
It's hard for me to pick. I know it's a cop-out, but Daily sometimes I'm just not into them, sometimes I'm really into them, but I tend to like the ones with very clever wordplay. We have a couple of older songs that have internal rhymes that move on, and when we nail that, and when we get the words right and everybody's in, they're gold.
I would think that Gray Funnel Line would be one of your favorites just because you get to sing up front. It's not often the basses get to sing up front.
Well, the Gray Funnel Line's neat because we lay out this bass fog, and it's like blah, for about 3 minutes.
On the Gray Funnel Line, the finest ship that sails the sea is still a prison.
And when everybody's harmonizing on top of it and those chords lock, that's the neat moment. That's, I guess, really what I'm saying. When the songs are working, when we're really, really on fire, and those chords click, the audience gets to hear it, but when we're up there on stage and those chords lock, you can feel it in your bones, and there's just nothing more satisfying than a solid, locked chord with a bunch of guys. It's neat. I wish I could get more people up on stage. Like, you think it's cool out there? Come up here and check it out. It's, it sounds awesome up here.
On the Gray Funnel Line. Oh, Lord, if dreams were only real, I'd feel my hands on that wooden wheel. And with all my one more day on the Gray Funnel Line. I'll pass the time like some machine until blue water turns to green. Then I'll dance on sail the Gray Funnel Line no more. It's one more day on the Gray Funnel
Occasionally, you'll venture into the relative security of a foreign language, you know, either Irish with McGill Mar or Sospen Fach, which is one of my personal favorites. Is it a challenge to adopt those into something that you can perform?
Well, without being too erudite, yes, because we haven't made our living off of being intellectuals. It's tricky sometimes, but thank God the Irish are not intellectuals when it comes to a lot of their drinking songs, so we're able to at least adopt them.
But tonight is the night that I drink till I die.
Both the Welsh and Irish people are very forgiving,
yes,
of how we butcher their language, and I appreciate that forgiveness. It's difficult, especially with Irish songs, unless it's written phonetically. Welsh, forget it. I mean, what does five L's sound like?
Yeah, right?
And luckily, we know a couple of people who speak these languages natively, and they can sort of help us.
It's true. When you're reading a Welsh song, it's like a string of Canadian hockey players. There's no vowels at all.
And we have no idea what we're singing.
None.
I mean, we know the notes, but we don't know what the words are.
In fact, we sing Sospen Fach, and our one Welsh friend, Peter, he's very nice, Peter, he tells us it's about a saucepan, and I swear to God, it's probably about burning English at the stake, and we have no way of double-checking this. He can tell us it could be about anything. Oh, it's about a saucepan. Uh-huh, okay, sure, right.
He might be telling the truth. We don't know.
Does Google Translate do Welsh? I don't know.
Well, you know, I haven't checked. It didn't when I wrote I Wear No Pants, or otherwise there would have been a Welsh verse.
There's something you can throw in for the next fair. You know,
there you go. That.
When you're not singing madrigals and shanties, you even venture into more modern styles. And one of my favorites, on Live or Let Die, you do two variations of the song Remember Me, one of which is from the perspective of a sailor, one of them is from the perspective of a musician on tour. Can you tell me a little bit about that and why you did two different versions of the song?
The night that I went off to sail the sea.
I wrote the original version, which is the one from the perspective of the sailor, and we were finishing that song up. We tried to put a bonus track. We don't do it as much anymore, but we used to try to put a sort of a hidden track on the end of the CD that's very different from what we normally do, and we didn't have one for Liver yet. And I think it was like the last day of recording, or it was like the second to last day of recording.
I remember hair and her warm summer smile. I remember caressing.
And Bill was in the studio, and he's listening to Remember Me, the original version that Jerry sings. And he suddenly looks at me, and he has this inspired look in his eye, and he starts writing something down.
Now, when Bill starts writing something, he gets that twinkle in his eye, he starts writing something down, something great is going to happen. Bill majored in music. He doesn't do music for a living now, and it constantly frustrates him. So when that twinkle happens, you know that all those years of pent-up frustration of writing music are going to spill out in a brilliant form.
And I could kill him because it takes him like 5 minutes to come up with something brilliant.
Right.
So he actually wrote that whole thing out literally in like 5 or 10 minutes there in the booth. And we used some of the same tracks to record it. And then our engineer said, oh, you know, I have a friend who can come in and put drums on this. And then I think we spent like another few hours the next day kind of fleshing the thing out.
Bill's phrase was, Stu, rock ballad.
But that was very spur of the moment, and it was just when we were casting about to try to come up with what our bonus track was going to be.
Your previous albums, just to name a few, Live or Let Die, Longer Than Life, which I always want to call Larger Than Life, throw that R in there, Whiskey Business, Anchor Management, and you've got another album coming out in the next few weeks. Tell us a little bit about it.
That's called Beer and Loathing.
So there's a theme here.
Yes, it's not a Hunter S. Thompson themed album. Basically, our album cover is kind of an homage to that style of illustration. Basically, it's a collection of the songs that we've written since our last album over the last 3 years.
It's actually quite an eclectic mix this time around, too.
There's a couple of traditional songs, Follow Me Up to Carlo, which is a traditional Irish tune. Hard Times Come Again No More, which is a Stephen Foster song. In a Garden So Green, which is a very old traditional. And then we have a lot of original songs. And then we've also re-recorded one of our songs, which is kind of a participant favorite called Long May the Burlap Wave, which I believe was on our first CD, Body Parts.
Yep.
I mean, the band has changed so much since then. And recording has changed so much since then. Our first album was recorded on 2-inch tape. And now everything's digital. That's how long we've been around.
Yeah.
And we re-recorded that, freshened it up some, expanded it, threw the kitchen sink at it. And then there's a lot of original music on this disc, too.
So what's the creative process like for the band? You said it's been quite a long while in the birthing of this album, but how do you guys come together and choose what music you're going to sing?
Well, usually we wait for Stu to write something.
Well, I'm one of the songwriters. There's the Schwadron brothers, Phil and Steven. They're actually quite prolific.
Very.
Phil writes lyrics and Steven puts it to music. Basically what will happen is someone will come to the band with a song, and then we go through the song, and I would say probably 90% of the time, the band says, yeah, this is a good song, let's go ahead and do it. And I think there's only been probably 4 or 5 songs over 21 years that have been rejected, and you don't want to hear about them.
No.
They either go too far, like they take the sort of ribald humor to the point of offending us, which is pretty hard.
Yeah.
Or whatever the concept for it is just doesn't quite work. We've had songs that we've decided not to do because they're way too anachronistic.
Thankfully, everybody in this group's pretty cool about it. They're like, yeah, all right, you're right. There's none of this, that's it, man, door slamming and stomping out. And at the end of the day, it's about making a good song. It's about giving the audience what they want, not about our egos.
How hard is it to write or prepare or arrange a song for 10 different people, especially when a couple times on a couple of different albums, it seems like all 10 or 12 of you are singing a different part at one point or another in the song?
Our bass arrangement is 4-part, sometimes 5. Tenor, lead, or baritone, second baritone and bass. There are a lot of very talented musicians in our group who get bored very quickly, and they will learn the part and then immediately add flourishes, or in the case of some of the tenors, they'll go higher than it's written. Some of the first baritones will add some inflections and things and change and add their own harmonies to them. But pretty much everything starts out as usually 4, sometimes 5-part harmony, and it's during the rehearsal process that grows and expands to, yes, sometimes 10 or 12.
Get the fans in the air, our great savior Berlin.
Long May the Burlap Wave is actually a perfect example. The music for that song was never written out, and the song was never arranged. It was arranged completely organically by the members of the band. And in fact, to this day, you cannot find a score of it.
Never seen a copy.
It is taught by ear to new members of the band, and they all know it. We're going to sound like Spinal Tap now. There have probably been, I'm going to guess, 18 or 20 members in the band at this point.
Yeah, the ones that don't explode at the drum set, yeah.
Every one of them learned that song the exact same way, because it was written in our first or second year, and it was taught by rote to everyone who's in the band.
And we actually noodled out much of the harmony while we were recording it.
The sky, the material.
Now, in addition to the fair, you guys also host your own concert, the Bog Fest. Traditionally, it's been at the Doubletree Hotel in Monrovia. Have you guys set a date for that?
Yes, it is Saturday, April 25th.
It is? Oh, my God. I better write that in.
You should. And it is, again, at the Doubletree. We try to start as close to 8 o'clock as we can, because we do a full day of fair, and then really try to shower. Then show up and try to do about 2 hours of music before we collapse out of exhaustion. It's a fun day. There's no cost. It's free. It's usually held out by the pool in the courtyard at the Doubletree. They usually have some kind of food for sale, and they set up a small bar out there for us as well.
It's not for us. It's for the people that are watching the Bogfest, but otherwise it'd be a bigger bar.
It's a small bar with a large back bar. There's a lot of kegs.
Do you go in there with a set list, or how does the Bogfest go?
We have a set list. I think I did one Bogfest where there wasn't a set list, and I'll never do that again. When you're calling a 25-minute show at fair, it's only going to be 6 or 7 songs. That's easy. But when you're talking about 2 hours, do we do this? Oh, wait, we just did that in the last set. Never mind. We'll just do something. I'll call something else.
Oh, wait, yeah. That's the fourth song we've done in D. Wait, maybe we should.
Right.
Oh, wait, the mandolin needs to capo. Did anybody got a capo? Is there a capo in the house? Yeah.
Yeah, there's definitely a set list for that one. But there's also shenanigans. It's still fairly unpredictable. The thing is, we're a local band that has a very loyal and active following, and we can pack people in. So if you have a venue that seats 500 to 700 people and you would like to fill it up, give us a call.
Our other thing is that we're not really an Irish band. People want to try to classify us. They want to say, what is it you guys do? You're an Irish band. You do Irish music. Like, no.
We do some.
Yeah. We're kind of hard to classify. So it's hard to sell ourselves to people. Once we get our foot in the door and we start performing and our fans show up, then they get it. But it's hard to say what it is we are.
Once we've had the opportunity to perform somewhere, not only are our fans, rabid, they will show up, they are polite, they don't get into fights, and they drink like fish.
Yeah.
I fool you not. We have played at least 3 bars where they ran out of alcohol.
Oh, wouldn't you like to have a pint of beer? Life is full of pain and misery. Oh, wouldn't you like to have a pint of beer? We'll raise a proper toast and keep you company.
Now, as a concert promoter, this is what you want, because you're making your money on the alcohol. We're not promoting drinking heavily. We are just saying our fans are good people.
I should amend that. I think at the El Rey, they ran out of Guinness.
Twice. They had to send out for more.
Right. They went to the grocery store down the street.
Yes. Part of the thing that works against us is you've seen our show. You've listened to us. How would you classify us as? Because your guess is as good as mine. And when we try to sell ourselves to a venue, how do we describe what it is we do?
A cappella group singing men's songs. Except you're not a cappella.
See? And then it's a slippery slope from there.
Yeah.
So if people want to learn more about the band, where can they go?
You can go to boggards.com, boggards.com. And that will take you right to our webpage. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. If you go to our webpage, there's a link there that says Buy Our Music, and it takes you to CD Baby, which is where all great independent bands go to have their music distributed and get on iTunes. Amazon MP3 store and Google Play, all those things.
If you type in Poxy Boggards, that's POXY space BOGGARDS songs and or music, there's lots and lots of things that come up. But we have 10, 12 albums out?
Including the EP we put out for I Wear No Pants, we have 11.
And finally, if someone wants to come out and see you in person at the fair, where can they find you?
Most of the time at the Rogues Reef stage. When you get into the fair, you get a program. They give you a map. Just look for the Rogues Reef stage and follow your nose. We do 3 shows a day there. It's usually like around 11, 1:30, and 3:30, usually. And then we usually do a late afternoon set around 5 or 5:30 at the Golden Jubilee stage. And that's the clean set, but that's the one it's safe to bring the kids to.
All right. Well, Stu Venable and Greg Stork Wilson of the Poxy Boggers, thank you so much for chatting with us here on KVC Arts.
Thank you very much.
It's been a pleasure. It's just nice that you actually found us. Thanks for doing the footwork to track us down.
Well, I will tell you, I'm one of the people that found you because I saw the commercial. I'm like, oh, that's hilarious.
Really?
Then I Googled you and I'm like, oh, they're Ren Faire. Okay, I haven't been to the Ren Faire. You know, I live in Redlands, so I'd been to the San Bernardino one before they moved. I went out there and I told my wife, like, okay, we're going to stay here for a while because these are my people. You know, I sang in college when Tender Love Ballad was sung. I turned to her and she kind of looked at me like, really, you're going to do this? I'm like, yes, of course I'm going to do this.
See, so you get it. But you're a choir geek.
I sing your parts when I'm driving home.
Very
nice. Just because I can. So. All right, gentlemen, I appreciate it. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
Take care.
Ross French in conversation with Stu Venable and Greg Wilson of the Poxy Boggards. More information on the band, again, at Simply Enough, poxyboggards.com. Well, simple enough with the spelling anyway. That's poxyboggards.com.
How wouldn't you like to have a pint of beer? Life is full of pain and misery. How wouldn't you like to have a pint of beer? We'll raise a proper toast to keep you company. We'll raise a proper toast to keep you company.
Just about going to wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks once again to Ross French for tracking down Stu Venable and Greg Wilson of the Poxy Boggards. Thanks also to J.J. Terry, amongst the voices on Space Racers, part of the KVCR-TV Kids Block programming. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Lindsay Weisgarver, Sean Houlihan, Emmanuel Rogers, and General Manager Alfredo Cruz. Most of the music heard tonight has come from the Poxy Boggards, a lot of it from their newest release, just out a couple of weeks, maybe. Other music beds and themes heard on KVC Arts, Behind Us Now, for example, composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. And David Fleming, thanks especially to you for listening and for your support. And speaking of which, here's Rick Dulock to talk to you about support.